growing of a wider and more ominous revolt. A revolt by consumers against all advertising, as mobile technology brought ads more intimately and insistently into people's lives, but at the same time gave them new tools to block them. The marketing community gulped when Apple, which three decades before had famously aired a TV ad that declared a rebellion against the ruling IBM computer Goliath, now seemed to want to smash most advertising. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, stood on a San Francisco stage late that summer and announced that Apple would offer a new operating system for iPhones and iPads that would contain apps empowering users to block ads. Apple, which received less than 1% of its revenues from advertising, was helping consumers seal their devices from ads. For consumers annoyed by intrusive pre-roll and banner ads, sluggish ad page load speeds, and uninvited marketing messages draining their batteries, or worried that their privacy was being invaded, this was a happy solution. "The user experience must be paramount," Apple proclaimed. "No, no," proclaimed websites, media companies, marketers, and ad-reliant companies like Facebook and Google. "Our ability to inform users and subsidize content is crippled by ad blockers." Those dependent on advertising accused Apple and ad blockers of murder. Apple and ad blocker advocates accused advertisers of committing suicide with mindless and intrusive ads. What neither Apple nor Google said publicly was that Apple's maneuver was part of a raging war between Apple and Google for smartphone supremacy. Apple made its money selling hardware and software. Google made its money selling ads. Apple was strategically offering consumers something Google couldn't. In a June 2015 speech to the Electronic Privacy Information Center, Cook came down hard on how his neighbors in Silicon Valley have built their businesses by lulling their customers into complacency about their personal information, and were monetizing it. "You might like these so-called free services, but we don't think they're worth having your email, your search history, sold off for God knows what advertising purpose." And consumers were getting Cook's message. As Tim Wu puts it in The Attention Merchants, "Internet users have begun to realize that when an online service is free, you're not the customer. You're the product." Within weeks, Apple's ad-blocking foray was duplicated by rival Samsung, which announced that it would include ad-blocking plugins to the operating system of its popular Android phones. For the communities dependent on the flow of advertising dollars, the speedy adoption of ad blockers conjured nightmare images of Napoleon's final battle at Waterloo. A study by PageFair and Adobe estimated that 200 million consumers worldwide and 40 million in the United States used ad blockers, a number that jumped 41% in 2015, wiping out an estimated $20 billion of ad sales. This number was expected to double in 2016. It was akin, the study concluded, to the largest consumer boycott in history. In one sense, ad blockers are not novel. As we've seen, more than half of consumers who record programs on a DVR or the equivalent skip the ads. But at least they have to make the effort to do so. AdBlock Plus, based in Cologne, Germany, is the world's largest purveyor of a free app users download to block ads. The app does not block all ads. AdBlock Plus offers a whitelist known as the Acceptable Ads Initiative, usually meaning ads they consider non-interruptive. However, for sites that wish to be whitelisted, AdBlock Plus taxes larger sites 30% of their ad revenue to allow the ad to appear. They say they don't charge smaller publishers, but will also block their ads if they are intrusive. Not surprisingly, members of the advertising community described the company's business plan as the Interactive Advertising Bureau CEO Randall Rothenberg did in a public speech, as an old-fashioned extortion racket gussied up in the flowery but false language of contemporary consumerism. When Till Fayda, a founder and the CEO of Adblock Plus, and Rothenberg were to appear back-to-back at a TechCrunch confab in early 2016 on the Brooklyn waterfront, the 2,500 attendees expected sparks to fly. The topic? The end of the ad era. Before the audience, Fayda repeated his mantra several times. Adblock Plus was user-friendly and was installed because you can't have a business that relies on pissing off your users. Instead of personal rants, he said Rothenberg and his organization should have set ad standards years ago. When he finished, Anthony Ha, the moderator, thanked him. As Fayda, a large burly man, exited the stage and the slight Rothenberg silently walked past, the moderator invited Rothenberg to pause and shake Fayda's hand. Rothenberg kept walking. His aim was to state the opposition case, and he did. He assailed ad blockers for robbing publishers, particularly small publishers. Some websites, he claimed, were losing 40% of their revenues. If ad blockers were really in the public service business as they profess, he asked, why not do it for free? Fayda sat alone backstage watching Rothenberg on a TV monitor. He's making a point of not engaging in a dialogue with us, Fayda said when Rothenberg finished. By sticking his head in the sand, he's pretending this will go away. Rothenberg later confirmed he had no interest in a dialogue with people he considers thieves. Ad blockers were a clear and present danger, and marketers and publishers struggled to devise a counterattack. Worried clients turned to Michael Kassin and MediaLink for advice and reassurance, as they did after John Mandel's ANA speech. It shook everybody, Wenda Millard says. No one could predict what would happen. She and Kassin agreed that ad blocking was a menace and a form of theft. But they also advised clients to create different kinds of ads and to take more responsibility for lousy ads. We said stop making websites that look like Tokyo at night, Millard said. Improve the ads, make the ads beautiful. The marketing community threw a number of countermeasures against the wall, hoping to see what would stick. German publisher Axel Springer filed a lawsuit asking that ad blockers be declared illegal. 1,200 American newspapers joined in a cease and desist letter to ad blockers, charging that they were blatantly illegal. Jerry Wind from the Wharton School decried this approach as dumb. Blocking the ad blockers, as some people in the industry want to do, is the dumbest thing you can do, he said. The consumer is sending you a message, I hate your advertising. Instead of saying, okay, let's change what we're doing, those idiots are trying to block the ad blockers. It's almost as dumb as what the record companies tried to do when Napster came out, suing their customers. Thus far, the courts do not seem to be an effective venue in which to defeat ad blockers. By the fall of 2017, both the lower and appeals courts in Germany upheld the right of consumers to block ads. One-party states like China simply decree that ad blockers are illegal. Publications like the Washington Post and Forbes banned users from accessing their sites unless they turned off their ad blockers. The Guardian tried a different tack, using pop-ups to tell users that their ad blockers erased monies that subsidized good journalism and offered alternate ways for them to aid journalism. Instead of joining lawsuits, the World Federation of Advertisers agreed. The internet advertising experience is not satisfactory for consumers. They called for less alienating ads. Since Facebook is an app, and ad blockers live on browsers, not mobile apps, Facebook was not as threatened as Google and others. But since it is an ad-dependent business, it took measures to try to prevent ad blockers from appearing on desktop computers using Facebook. The industry's preferred antidote to combat ad blockers was native advertising, which was unlikely to be blocked because its camouflage fooled the ad censors. Wherever one went in 2015 and early 2016, visiting a publication, a client, an agency, native advertising or branded content was invoked as a great hope. Michael Kassin was a believer. He saw ad blockers as an opportunity, not just a disruptor. Native advertising was the remedy he promoted to publishing clients like Condé Nast, Hearst, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Time Inc., and Vox, and to brand clients like AT&T and Disney, among many others. Native ads would be much more effective storytellers than their beta version, advertorials. Sounding evangelical, he envisioned a world where consumers wouldn't be able to tell the difference between news and advertising. The creators of those ads would often be the publishers or the brands, not the ad agencies. Hearst and Condé Nast are now content companies, meaning ad agencies, he said. If every brand today wants to create content, as opposed to interrupting you with a commercial, then what the hell do I need a commercial for? I want to reach a point where premium content is like pornography. A nirvana is when you can't tell the difference between the content and the advertising. You're actually in good shape because the consumer is going to get your message through branded content, or whatever you want to call it. Some would call it deceptive advertising. Native does not offer salvation. Native ads in 2015 generated a total of only $7.5 billion ad dollars in the United States. A Facebook study projected that by 2020, worldwide native advertising would reach $53.4 billion. The Atlantic Monthly reported that three-quarters of its online ad revenue in 2015 came from native advertising. Slate attributed half its ad revenues to native. This sounds better than it is, for the same digital ad usually generates about 10 to 20 cents compared to $1 for the same print ad. Unlike TV or print ads that are repeatedly shown, native ads do not readily lend themselves to repetition. Native can take many forms. To market its Narcos miniseries, Netflix paid the freight for the Wall Street Journal's in-depth native ad report on the Medellin drug cartel, including motion graphics, video clips from the miniseries, and a Spanish language option. Separate from the journal's native promotion of Narcos, the newspaper reported a lengthy story on the Medellin drug cartel on which the series is based. When asked directly if Netflix helped sustain the cost of this reporting, its chief communications officer, Jonathan Friedland, a former journal reporter, emailed, "It works like this. We go to news organization X and say, hey, we would like you to come up with some ideas to enhance interest in show Y. They come back with themes and constituent elements in support of those, and we decide which ones we like. At Netflix, at least, I have insisted when the marketing folks embark on this type of thing, they give the news organization complete freedom. This is but one example of how the traditional wall between the business and the news side was lowered." Another prominent native campaign occurred in November 2015, when the New York Times teamed up with Google and General Electric and paid for 1 million Google Cardboard virtual reality plastic lenses to view a GE video produced in-house by the Times. How nature is inspiring our industrial future. The viewer is drawn into an animated world where animals and butterflies alchemize into GE wind turbines and a city. This campaign, like many native ad campaigns, bypassed the agency middleman. A lot of clients are frustrated, Vice Chair Beth Comstock says of GE and others. We want more media properties to come to us like the New York Times did. Inevitably, native ads create a tension between the interests of journalism and the interests of the advertiser. As the Washington Post's Margaret Sullivan, one-time public editor of the Times, put it, if native ads look too much like journalism, they damage credibility. If they look nothing like journalism, they lose their appeal to advertisers. A fine line indeed. A vocal minority of those in the advertising industry assail native ads for crossing a line because they undermine trust. Native advertising is not new. the chairman emeritus of DDB Worldwide, Keith Reinhardt, says. We used to call it advertorials. And it will not be around because it compromises both the media and the brand. Trying to draw a line, the Federal Trade Commission in November 2015 did issue guidelines for native advertising. The FTC's aim was to prohibit native ads that mask the signals consumers customarily have relied upon to recognize an advertising or promotional message. Although the FTC acknowledged that deception was not always clear-cut, they insisted there was a line. Yet many publishers reacted as if the guidelines were invisible. MediaRadar, a cloud-based ad sales platform utilized by 1,600 publishers, issued a study in 2016 revealing that nearly 40% of publishers did not comply with FTC guidelines. Surveys revealed that native ads tricked consumers because they did not notice the difference between a news story and a native ad. A nonprofit organization, the Online Trust Alliance, reported in 2016 that 71% of consumers were successfully tricked. The introduction of ad blockers and native ads is a symptom of two much larger disruptive forces. First, of course, the surge of the mobile phone platform. Second, in addition to the advent of the mobile phone, we have two generations of computer-literate citizens who have grown up with access to ad-free options, like Netflix, HBO, and to DVRs that enable ad skipping. The year 2015 seemed to be the year mobile phones captured the full attention of the marketing industry. Speaking before the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona in early 2016, Martin Sorrell castigated big agencies and big advertisers for being late to comprehend the mobile upheaval. Mobile is not just an extension of digital, just a way to reach consumers, he said. It is perhaps the most important channel to consumers that has been developed, and it changes the way you live your life by virtue of the fact that it is always on. It's 24/7, and we've never had this. In her much-anticipated annual presentation on The State of the Web, Mary Meeker of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield Byers reported that mobile phone users had rocketed from 80 million worldwide in 1995 to 5.2 billion in 2014, or three-quarters of the Earth's population. We have never in history adopted a technology faster, Carolyn Everson told a CES audience in January 2016, noting that it took radio 38 years to reach 50 million people, and television only 13 years. Mobile phones reached 7.2 billion people in just 30 years. Perhaps the most significant reaction to the mobile revolution came from Facebook. When Facebook went public in May 2012, its IPO filing said it did not generate any meaningful revenue from mobile. Yet founder Mark Zuckerberg knew his users were switching from desktop to mobile, and Facebook's mobile product, Carolyn Everson says, was not good. Zuckerberg had to turn his ocean liner as sharply as a speedboat. Twice annually, he holds an all-hands meeting with the staff, and he abruptly ended a 2011 meeting when members of a product team came in with a product mock-up for a desktop computer. He insisted that he wanted mobile mock-ups. If you come in and try to show me a desktop product, I'm going to kick you out, he said. Over the next 2 weeks, Everson says, everyone canceled their product meetings with Zuckerberg, frantically seeking to devise a mobile strategy. Over the next 8 weeks, all Facebook engineers were retrained. By the end of 2012, one quarter of Facebook's revenues came from mobile. By the following year, it was half. By 2016, 80% of Facebook's revenues came from mobile phone marketing. By 2019, the research firm eMarketer projected, ad spending on mobile would reach $65.4 billion and dominate 70% of all digital ad spending. Mark Zuckerberg knew Facebook was doomed if it could not reach its young audience on mobile. The two younger generations were such a disruptive force because they are a prime audience targeted by advertisers since they are thought to shape future buying habits. They consist of millennials, those age 21 to 34, and of Generation Z, those 21 and younger, with teenagers being the heart of this generation. Of the two, we know less about Generation Z. One Monday afternoon in early 2016, MediaLink invited to its conference room a client, Awesomeness TV, to share what they know of Generation Z. Awesomeness TV is a Santa Monica digital TV production company with its own YouTube channel that is wildly popular with this generation. To better understand Generation Z, they formed a youth marketing firm, Wildness. The chief strategy officer of Wildness, Margaret Chesler, a former vice president at the digital ad agency Razorfish, was introduced by Wenda Millard. Chesler discussed what she said was the largest study of Generation Z ever conducted, a survey of 3,000 members of this generation, as well as in-depth interviews. She described Generation Z this way. It represents 34% of the world's population, and they see themselves as culture creators, not passive receivers of information. Every 60 seconds, they upload 500,000 hours of video to YouTube and 528,000 photos to Snapchat. They prize authenticity above all. 94%, the vast majority, told us their highest social value is to be true to themselves. While surveys reveal that becoming wealthy is the second most valued goal of millennials, she said, it's not even in the top 20 of this generation. The opportunity for brands is to get real and to be consistent. By way of illustration, she reported that 70% prefer video streamed over the internet to TV or cable. Why? They don't want to be interrupted. They hate ads. They like YouTube because people are real and authentic. They would prefer to subscribe to ad-free services, assuming they could afford to. They also have the shortest attention span of any generation, she warned. Although there are real differences between millennials and Generation Z, for marketers, the similarities are meaningful, she said. Both share an aversion to being interrupted by ad messages. Both spend less time in front of television sets, get more news from Facebook than newspapers, multitask on multiple devices, tend to have attenuated attention spans, and are devoted to their smartphones. If a marketer wishes to capture the attention of both with a mobile ad, it has to be done in a second or two. Whatever the obstacles, Chesler said marketers can reach younger consumers. Their pitches have to be shorter, maybe using pictures and emojis and messages like 6-second Vine videos rather than words. The real challenge for brands is to create experiences that are powerful and to understand their quest for authenticity. Chesler did not have to tell them that this is a reason brand advertisers increasingly emphasize in their marketing messages the services they perform, the social good they do, the brand values they share, as if makers of sugary drinks and fatty hamburgers are public servants. This generation, she said, is willing to hear from brands, and 91% said they would be willing to share their views with brands. They like branded content because it is much more real, which is the same reason they like YouTube videos. They are not overly polished. The MediaLink staff perked up at the news that Generation Z was reachable, but in non-traditional ways. Just to be sure, Wenda Millard asked, "They really don't like ads?" 84% told us they don't like advertising, Chesler responded. "That could be a problem," Millard cracked. "They like branded," Chesler said. "They don't like to be interrupted." The takeaway, Millard concluded, they don't like advertising as we know it. The consumer was a frenemy. Not liking advertising has a long history, certainly in America. Both in the progressive era when the muckrakers exposed false marketing claims, and again during the Depression, when corporations and advertisers were in bad odor, federal agencies were forged to police false advertising. Perhaps the most renowned critique of advertising and its manipulative powers was a book written by Vance Packard, previously an author of such fluff magazine pieces as How I Lost 15 Pounds in 1 Month. Moved by a genuine sense of outrage, Packard published The Hidden Persuaders in 1957, and it quickly shot up to number one on bestseller lists. He lambasted advertisers for treating consumers as gullible children. The heart of Packard's thesis was this. This book is an attempt to explore a strange and rather exotic new area of American life. It is about the large-scale efforts being made, often with impressive success, to channel our unthinking habits, our purchasing decisions, and our thought processes by the use of insights gleaned from psychiatry and the social sciences. Typically, these efforts take place beneath our level of awareness, so that the appeals which move us are often, in a sense, hidden. The result is that many of us are being influenced and manipulated far more than we realize in the patterns of our everyday lives. David Ogilvy granted ammunition to critics of advertising when in a 1955 speech to the American Association of Advertising Agencies, he admitted, "There really isn't any significant difference between the various brands of whiskey, or the various cigarettes, or the various brands of beer. They are all about the same. And so are the cake mixes and the detergents and the margarines and the automobiles. And, I might add, the different brands of salt. The difference," he said, "is found in the advertising and the emotion it creates." Or, as MediaLink's Wenda Millard says, "At its heart, advertising is about creating desire." Creating desire is what alarms James Steyer, founder and CEO of Common Sense Media, a children's advocacy organization focused on the harm media can inflict on children. He worries about advertising that promotes unhealthy sugary drinks or fast food, but he said his fear could be defined more broadly. The ubiquity of advertising can turn little children into overly commercial human beings. They think of being defined by material things. Little kids don't know the difference between ads and programming. My 12-year-old son constantly wants new sneakers. Wanton consumerism has forever been blamed on advertising. Michael Shudson, who taught a course at the University of Chicago called Mass Media and Society, says he would freely assert in class that advertising was usually ineffective. He was inspired to study the impact of advertising because "I did not have an adequate response to students who asked why companies would spend so much on ads if they got little return." In the book he would write about the industry, Advertising, The Uneasy Persuasion, Shudson explored advertising's sins. He compared advertising to the art of socialist realism because "it does not claim to picture reality as it is, but reality as it should be." He labeled it capitalist realism, and said ads are designed, whether successful or not, to subordinate messy reality in order to spike sales of a product. Among the hidden efforts of advertisers, critics most often latch onto how marketing manipulates our emotions. Industry leaders don't deny this, they extol it. Jack Haber, who retired as CMO of Colgate in 2017, says, "I'm a believer that consumers make decisions emotionally." As proof, he cites Daniel Kahneman's esteemed best-selling book, Thinking, Fast and Slow, to demonstrate that most human decisions pivot on emotion. If you look at how people make decisions to buy things, people make decisions emotionally. That's why we try to build an emotional connection to a brand. Colgate spent $5 million for a 30-second spot in the 2016 Super Bowl that didn't mention toothpaste, but instead urged viewers to save water by not leaving the water running. Colgate is the most trusted brand in the world, he says, and he believes this Super Bowl ad reinforced the emotional connection people have with Colgate. One of the most celebrated ads ever was the Coca-Cola commercial that was the final scene of Mad Men. It featured children of all colors from around the world giving viewers goosebumps as they harmonized on a hilltop. "I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company. That's the real thing." The ad tells nothing of the product or its ingredients, or why it's the real thing. Keith Reinhard defends the ad and the emotions it evoked because the ad is part of the brand experience, whatever that means. We have always known intuitively, he explains, that people make their brand decisions, by the way, the same way they make their political decisions, emotionally, with that lizard part of the brain, the reptilian part. Mark Pritchard, chief brand officer of Procter & Gamble, tersely explained to an Advertising Week audience why his product, Old Spice, had rebounded. The advertising for Old Spice is about ridiculous masculinity. And it works. It certainly worked for CBS, owner of broadcast rights for the February 2016 Super Bowl. The annual event offers the biggest audience of the year to advertisers, which is why CBS was able to charge up to $5 million for each spot. It was not exactly edifying fare. Bud Light had comedians Amy Schumer and Seth Rogen paired up to disagree whether the nation was divided this presidential year and to agree to canvass America to promote the Bud Light Party. Audi was praised for its storytelling in their ad, Commander, in which an elderly, utterly depressed former astronaut will not eat or talk, and just stares ahead. His son enters the room, takes his hand, they walk outside, and in the driveway is an Audi R8 sports car that can reach 205 miles per hour. The father takes the keys to the sound of David Bowie's Starman, and he magically smiles. There is no way for an Alzheimer's family to watch this without gasping, in shock, wrote Media Post columnist Bob Garfield. One explanation for advertising's constant stretch to transfix audiences is that advertising is really a form of show business. Randall Rothenberg, CEO of the Interactive Advertising Bureau and a longtime student of advertising, suggests as much. Contemporary advertising is based on the deliberate, playful wink-wink of P.T. Barnum. It's based on the idea that if you shout loud enough, tell clever enough stories, you can get people to do anything. No question, many marketing pitches are brilliant, and more than a few advance a social good, as P&G's Ariel detergent ads did in India. Unilever's Vaseline did for Syrian refugees. Nike's If You Let Me Play ads did in promoting Title IX and girls participating in team sports. And as RGA's inspiring anti-bias public service ad, Love Has No Labels, did. But if one acknowledges that many marketing pitches are hyperbolic, then one holds hands with truthful hyperbole, the phrase Donald Trump described in his book The Art of the Deal as an innocent form of exaggeration and a very effective form of promotion. From here, the distance to alternative facts is a mere step or two. So as is often the case, two opposing things are true at once. The social mobile data revolution has made consumers more skeptical of advertising, even as ever more immersive and intimate technologies have given advertising more and better purchase over our emotions. And we've barely glimpsed the impact of virtual reality on the world of marketing. As Daniel J. Boorstin famously wrote in his 1961 book, The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America, we risk being the first people in history to have been able to make their illusions so vivid, so persuasive, so realistic, that they can live in them. More than 50 years later, this is still not a comforting thought. 11. Can old media be new? Lucrative new revenue streams explain why network television, unlike financially ailing traditional media like newspapers, magazines, and radio, is not on life support. By 2016, Les Moonves' CBS was making more money than when he joined CBS 20 years before. Les Moonves, the 67-year-old CEO and chairman of CBS, measured the success of the 2016 Super Bowl by the quantity, not quality, of the ads. It was the third most watched Super Bowl in history, and CBS was charging $5 million per ad. The ad sales went through the roof, says Moonves, arms folded across a blue pinstriped suit as he relaxed in the ornate, spacious 35th floor BlackRock office that was once founder William Paley's. It was the second highest day in ad revenues in the history of any media. The only time it was beat was by ourselves with the Mayweather versus Pacquiao fight, the so-called fight of the century. We did $400 million for the day on the Super Bowl. The ebullient Moonves had more than a Super Bowl to celebrate in February 2016. Under his leadership, by the end of the 2014-15 season, CBS had gone from last in the early 1990s to first in the primetime ratings race for 12 of the last 13 years, and 2015-16 would make it 13 out of 14. He was handsomely compensated for his labors, receiving a pay package in 2015 of $56.8 million. He could also celebrate that CBS was no longer 100% reliant on advertising. The federal government in the early 90s initiated two measures with profound financial implications for the networks. The first came when Congress passed the Cable Act, requiring cable companies to compensate broadcasters for offering CBS and other programs on cable systems. The second was when the FCC rescinded the Financial Interest and Syndication Rules, FinCEN, allowing networks to own and sell their programs. In addition, unlike two decades ago, the networks no longer compensated their affiliated stations to carry their programs, and new digital platforms now paid the networks to show their programs. By 2015, new revenue spigots enabled CBS to derive half its revenue from non-advertising sources, including the nearly $1 billion CBS got from retransmission consent fees paid by the cable companies and reverse compensation paid by local stations to carry network programs, the $1.5 billion CBS received from being able to syndicate and sell its programs internationally, the approximately $1 billion CBS received in 2015 from the sale of its archived programs to digital platforms like Netflix, Amazon, and Apple. Lucrative new revenue streams explain why network television, unlike financially ailing traditional media like newspapers, magazines, and radio, is not on life support. By contrast, the newspaper industry lost more than half its jobs between January 2001 and September 2016. Les Moonves has been hailed as the Steve Jobs of television. For me, Les Moonves represents the North Star, Michael Kasson says, calling him a brilliant operator. You can never lose sight of the fact that he began his career as an actor. He's a showman. Josephine and Herman Moonves raised three children in the middle-class neighborhood of Valley Stream, just over the Queens border. She was a nurse, and her husband ran the three gas stations he inherited from his father. I got my competitiveness from my father and my sense of art from my mother, Moonves says. He was a good student and skilled at both tennis and baseball in high school and at Bucknell University, where he also performed in school plays. I was a very competitive athlete and competitive in virtually everything I did, he says. I like winning. After graduating from college in 1971, he moved to New York City with hopes of becoming an actor. After attending acting school and performing as a tough guy in series like The $6 Million Man and Cannon, it dawned on him that acting was a dead end for him. I knew I was a mediocre actor, he says. He segued to producing plays before joining the development office of Columbia Pictures to nurture and select TV sitcoms. After 2 years, he moved over to 20th Century Fox to develop movies of the week and miniseries. Recruited by Lorimar Television in 1985 to supervise its movies and miniseries, he would rise to be head of creative affairs and then president. When Lorimar merged with Warner Brothers, he was elevated to CEO of their combined television operations. Warner Brothers Television thrived. 1 year, he successfully sold 23 shows to various networks, including Friends and ER. Even as a mediocre actor, he believes his experience before the camera made him a better program executive. I knew what to look for in a script and in talent. With CBS lagging in last place among the four networks in prime time, the network recruited Moonves to become president of its entertainment division in 1995. Ratings rose, as did he, first to CEO of CBS Television, and then in 2003 to CEO of all of CBS. The corporate parent of CBS was by now Viacom, and its chairman, Sumner Redstone, divided the company into Viacom, with its cable and Paramount Pictures, and CBS. Although Moonves's range of responsibilities is wide, in addition to the network, he oversaw its TV stations, its TV studios and distribution arm, its HBO pay TV competitor Showtime, its CW network, CBS Radio, CBS Interactive, outdoor advertising, and Simon & Schuster, among other divisions, he still micromanages the entertainment division. He says he reads 20 scripts each week, and no pilot gets greenlit without my approval. And none of the four or five lead actors on a show gets hired without my approval. He has programmed some series worthy of the Tiffany Network tag that originally attached to CBS, like The Good Wife. But he does not pretend to be a highbrow. This is reflected not just in the many formulaic programs that helped propel CBS to ratings glory, like NCIS, The Amazing Race, and Hawaii Five-0, but also what he describes as the delicious candy of series he wishes he owned, like the 10 episodes of The People vs. O.J. Simpson on the FX network. Moonves attributes part of his success to a core team of executives who have been at his side for a minimum of a dozen years. His favorite movie is The Godfather, and to members of his team, he is seen as a benign version of Don Corleone. He is 100% accessible to me and my team, Joanne Ross, the lauded president of CBS sales for more than two decades, says. I never want to disappoint him. His second wife, Julie Chen, once told The Hollywood Reporter, "If you cross him, he doesn't forget. You're dead to him." He feared he was, figuratively, dead in late 2005 when Sumner Redstone announced that the parent company would be split into two separate entities, Viacom and CBS. Moonves was unhappy, believing he was stuck with slow-growing assets like radio, publishing, billboards, and even the CBS network, all of which Wall Street punished because they were pigeonholed as old media. He wanted some of Viacom's fast-growing cable assets and its movie manufacturing arm, Paramount Pictures. However, within a few years, Viacom's stock tumbled, and CBS's soared. By February 2016, Viacom had a market value of $12.4 billion, half of its former worth, while CBS was now worth nearly twice as much as Viacom. He is the only guy since Bill Paley who is both a businessman and a showman, says George Schweitzer, president of CBS Marketing for two decades. We've had businessmen and showmen. We've not had both. The showman might have to be waterboarded to publicly admit the perils ahead for CBS, as newspapers are more reliant on Facebook to distribute its content. Moonves privately knows he is increasingly dependent for revenues on digital platforms that lustily compete for the attention of viewers. He says he is comfortable with this because we are a content company. Now that CBS is allowed to own and produce programs, it is a television studio, not just a network platform for other studios. Netflix is a friend. They pay us a lot of money, he says. Netflix just paid us $5.5 million per episode for Star Trek outside of the U.S. All in, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. Netflix is also a classic frenemy, for while CBS receives revenue from them, it has built up a competitor. Irwin Gottlieb thinks Moonves and the other networks that sell programs to Netflix and Amazon and other streaming platforms are potentially sowing the seeds of their own destruction by selling their content to Netflix and any other subscriber VOD, video on demand, system. Netflix is a colossus. Already, it estimates that its subscribers watch 1 billion hours per week, and by the end of 2017, It expected to have 116 million subscribers, nearly half of them in the United States. CBS and the other networks today have smaller programming budgets than Netflix or Amazon. And at the same time, Google and Facebook are siphoning more of CBS's ad dollars. Moonves's optimism is predicated, in part, on his bet that cable system owners will continue to pump more dollars into paying retransmission fees to the networks to air their programs, a sum he believes will climb close to $2 billion by 2020. His bet relies on three assumptions. He assumes that growing consumer pressure to break up cable bundles will not weaken cable's ability to make those payments. He assumes that by selling network programs to cable competitors, like Netflix, he will not retard cable's willingness to make those payments. And he believes, as he says flatly, that cable needs the networks. Moonves the salesman does not wail publicly about the perils ahead for CBS. Michael Kassin will surely advise his clients to invest more ad dollars elsewhere, including digital platforms like Google and Facebook, which by 2017 were poised to receive more ad dollars than the traditional ad sales champ, television. Erwin Gottlieb may refuse to pay steeper prices for ads on CBS because its audience is not growing, and the number of those who watch ads on CBS shrinks. A generation accustomed to not watching ads will drive brand clients away from expensive 30- and 60-second ads. Les Moonves is not deaf. He's heard marketers like Michael Kassin say quite publicly that at some point soon advertisers will insist on paying less and will shift dollars elsewhere. He has reason to fear how CBS will pay for expensive quality drama series that after several seasons of star salaries can cost up to $10 million per hour. And while CBS has nicely diversified its revenue streams, with only half its revenues now coming from ads, one out of every $2 is still an irreplaceable revenue stream. These perils became public in the summer of 2015, when Disney CEO Bob Iger acknowledged that ESPN was for the first time losing subscribers. 3.2 million subscribers, Nielsen reported, and thus there is an inevitability to ESPN peeling itself away from the traditional pay TV bundle. Iger went on to say, eventually, ESPN would be sold directly to the consumers, streamed over the internet, just as Netflix is. This unsettled the easily rattled financial markets. Because ESPN had always been a financial juggernaut, Wall Street clamored to ask, if ESPN bypasses the cable middleman, with the most popular programming in the cable package removed, did this doom the cable bundle? Did it mean more viewers would rebel against the expensive cable bundle and cut the cord? With cable stressed, did this mean broadcasters would lose some of the retransmission fees cable pays? If ESPN's growth has stalled, did this mean popular sports programming has hit its ceiling? Didn't this demonstrate that broadcasters substantially overpaid for sports rights? And if Disney would pull ESPN from cable, did this mean that internet TV, like Netflix, is destined to replace traditional television? Didn't it mean viewers are fleeing from familiar television channels? As questions mounted, media stocks cratered, losing more than $100 billion of their value by the end of 2015. CBS's stock price fell by one-third. Wall Street went crazy, Moonves says. Wall Street was reacting, he told a reporter for Sports Business Daily, as if the whole ecosystem is failing. And that is just not true. The financial community was straining for a new narrative, and he defined it thus. Digital is taking over the universe. The old guys are dead. Moonves didn't believe that. CBS's profits belied it. But Michael Kassin, among others, believed the networks, like ESPN, were in a long-term downward spiral. The last bastion is sports, Kassin says. That's why the market crashed when Bob Iger made the comments about ESPN. Everyone said, oh my God, we know this is happening on ABC, but ESPN? That's like the joke about the guy who comes home and sees his wife in bed with his best friend and he looks and says to his friend, "I have to, but you?" Broadcast viewing tumbled badly between the start of the new season in September 2015 and December. The ratings of only three returning programs improved, Advertising Age reported, while 42 fell by an average of 25%. Cable programs also nosedived. As viewing choices multiply, the average TV home had 206 channel choices, according to Nielsen, so audiences bifurcate, leaving fewer viewers for each platform. And this does not include their internet and app options. Advertising dollars drifted down as well. The upfront sales marketplace, which usually begins in May and runs into summer, and where roughly three-quarters of ad dollars for the 2015-16 season would be invested, sank by an estimated 10% for broadcasters and 5% for cable networks. About $2 billion shifted from traditional to digital media. It is now conventional wisdom that the young, impatient with constant advertising interruptions and spoiled by being able to watch what and when they want without commercial interruption, and to be able to binge on it, will continue to abandon traditional television. David Poltrack, the venerated chief research officer for CBS, who has worked at the network for nearly 55 years, rejects this notion. He believes those who shun advertising and television are a passing fancy. The young may be tuned out to advertising and television today, he says, but that has always been true, and as they age, they will become more like their parents. Millennials between 25 and 34 watch 43% more TV than those 18 to 24, he says. Although one-third of each broadcast hour is devoted to advertising interruptions, and slightly more on most cable channels, he merrily insists, people do not object to advertising. They object to bad advertising and irrelevant advertising. People like advertising. Advertising informs people. Advertising entertains people. When you ask millennials whether they would pay even as little as a dollar not to have to watch ads, he says, 90% say they would prefer to watch ads. In a modest-size office surrounded by piles of research reports, Poltrack made another counterintuitive argument. Since 80% of those between 18 and 34 are simultaneously on the internet with another device when they watch their TV screen, that has resulted in the fact that they are more tolerant of advertising because they have something to do during the commercial breaks. They need those breaks to keep up the IMing with their friends and the tweeting. What? But they are not watching the ads? They are, he insists. There is research that shows those active on their devices are more likely to recall the advertising than those who weren't. Why? Because without a device, when you're sitting there and doing nothing, you'll look for something to do, and you are more likely to leave the room. But if you're still in front of the TV and you're accustomed to multitasking and the only sound in the room is the TV, this means their hearing is totally centered on the sound from their television set. Poltrack made a more startling claim during the annual summer 2015 press tour in Los Angeles. When you count current CBS programs on cable, and those streamed over the internet by CBS, and those that are recorded by DVRs or on video on demand from cable or satellite companies, and watched over a full month, if measurement services could track all these programs, and the multiple devices they are watched on, he claimed, our programs are being viewed by more people today than a decade ago. And millennials, he guessed, were not watching less TV. He suspected the devices they viewed them on were not measured by the rating services. He did acknowledge that the American population had swelled by 25 million in the 10 years he was counting, and this partly explains his thesis. Poltrack, like Moonves, chants this thesis like a mantra. In May 2017, CBS published a full-page ad in newspapers proclaiming that more people watch CBS today than 16 years ago. Does this claim have the virtue of being true? In 2016, Nielsen added a measurement tool that allows them to estimate the number of viewers up to 35 days after the program originally airs. They measure those who watch CBS primetime shows live, and those who watch them later on their DVRs or on VOD from their cable or satellite company. Even though the number of viewers does not account for those who watch CBS programs streamed digitally on multiple devices, Nielsen still confirms that CBS's claim regarding its shows is accurate. The ratings for a hit show may be a third of what they were 16 years ago, but the cumulative audience is slightly larger. But, and here's the rub, with ad skipping, the advertiser reaches a smaller audience, even though the overall audience is slightly larger. Plus, advertisers don't pay for CBS shows that appear the next season on ad-free digital platforms like Netflix and Amazon. Netflix, in the meantime, thrives. By 2016, Netflix had nearly as many subscribers as the entire U.S. cable industry. Television watching on all channels declined 3% in 2015, according to a study by Michael Nathanson, senior media analyst of Moffitt Nathanson, and Netflix viewing accounted for half the decline. One reason for that decline is ad fatigue. "We have overstuffed the bird," Kevin Riley, president of cable networks TBS and TNT, confessed to the Television Critics Association in early 2016. In a half-hearted attempt to reduce ad clutter, Riley's networks and the Fox network announced that they would reduce their ad loads, however slightly. NBC's Saturday Night Live said it was paring its commercial breaks by one-third. Others gingerly followed. Mindful that his cash register was filling nicely, Les Moonves declined to join. Asked if she worried about ad clutter, Joanne Ross says she doesn't. Maybe down the road this model gets tweaked. But so far, people haven't come to us and said, "I'm not buying you because you have too many commercials." Moonves was aware of other competitive threats, including Google's YouTube and Facebook, each of which commonly and falsely boast that their audience exceeds that of network TV. In June 2014, RBC Capital Markets' respected television and video analyst, David Bank, released a study revealing that for advertisers, the ratings value of watching YouTube for an entire week would only match the value of a single original episode of CBS's The Big Bang Theory. YouTube executives invented new ways to assert that their audience was bigger than it was. They proclaimed that their 23 videos from Jimmy Kimmel Live averaged 9 million views, more than the average 2.2 million viewers of the ABC Late Night Show in May 2015. Yet Steve Hasker, Nielsen's global president and COO, notes that TV viewing is measured by how many viewers watch in an average minute, while digital outlets like YouTube measure the gross number of times the video is viewed for either 1 minute or 1 second. Since Nielsen was only measuring the average audience in any given minute, the average hourly Kimmel show in May 2015 had 5.3 million views nightly and 43.1 million adults for the month. Unlike television, which has Nielsen to grade it, Hasker pointed out that Google and Facebook did not allow independent third-party measurement. Another long-term problem awaited Moonves, one that paralyzed most newspapers and magazines when they were first confronted by the digital threat in the late 1990s. Broadcast television could offer advertisers vast audiences, but they could not offer targeted ads and could not tell advertisers who actually watched their ads and bought their products. Unlike most newspapers and magazines, broadcast television remains a robust mass medium. However, unlike internet or digital video, it lacks the tools to target audiences. The addressable advertising that helps explain why digital advertising spending would catch up with the $70 billion ad dollars devoted to television. Moonves and his network brethren also resist computerized programmatic advertising that automates the targeting of audiences. Brian Lesser, the North American CEO of Group M, is not alone in predicting that all media will be digital, meaning the TV networks will be streamed over the internet, just as Netflix is, and all TV will be bought and sold programmatically. Moonves resists, believing that if he turned over ad sales to machines it would take the skill and the timing of the salesman or saleswoman out of the equation, reducing CBS's leverage. Programmatic buying is fraught with peril, he says. Somebody is selling inventory cheaper than you're selling it for. Networks like the mystery that the only way you can reach, say, women 18 to 49, is by watching Scandal. Also assailing Moonves and the networks was a 6 or 7 year old digital advertising bazaar, the New Front, meant to vie with traditional television's upfronts, the period in which the four major broadcast networks sell up to